Well, it's easy to assume that everything is fine with your pet, but like they say, an ounce of prevention can be worth a pound of cure. And with the busy holiday season, I think it's important to keep that in mind. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She takes time every month to spend with us to give us some advice on keeping your pet healthy and happy, and mine as well. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here on this cold day.
Yeah, well, that cold weather definitely is settled in over the state, as has the snow. What does that mean for keeping our pets safe and healthy?
Well, there's a number of things we have to realize. Every pet is different. And I have people ask me, like, what kind of temperatures can pets withstand? Well, if it's a little like dachshund with thin hair that is belly's rubbing in the snow, that's going to be a lot different than your husky or malamute or whatever. But there really isn't any dog out there that can survive, you know, for long periods of time, sub-zero weather. And so having shelter available for your dog, you know, just making sure that you've done all the preventive care that you can, get your dog in for a checkup. You know, simple things like, well, it's not that simple, but like arthritis can really be aggravated walking on snowy, bumpy sidewalks. And, you know, that may be something that requires some medical attention from the veterinarian as well. But it basically comes down to knowing your pet's limits, recognizing signs that they've had a little too much, sometimes being their brains and bringing them in sooner, and provide an outlet for their activities in the house. And so coming up with fetch games or find it games and maybe new interactive toys and things to really keep them occupied. And I think it's a great idea to make sure that every pet, even indoor cats, have some form of ID on them or in them, because if they do escape, I mean, they're going to be seeking shelter and they may get picked up by somebody rather than roaming where you can easily see them if you're out looking for them in the neighborhood. So microchipping, tags, and so on, I think are really important as well.
A lot of us have holiday gatherings coming up, and that can impact our pets as well. Lots of people, foods, and decorations.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's very stressful. We've already had one cat come in that ate a light bulb, one of those little mini light bulbs,
yeah.
You know, and so lots of things like that happen. And so, you know, keeping, you know, ornaments and things out of the pet's reach, ribbons, that type of stuff. Sometimes you have to decorate your house according to your pets. But one big myth that's out there that just came up yesterday, actually, on my way home from work, is the, you know, people talking about the dreaded poinsettia.
Oh.
That actually is not a toxic plant. It may cause a little bit of oral irritation or so, you know, if the pet licks it or chews on it, but it is not toxic. But there are some things like mistletoe berries and things that can be really problematic for pets. And so, again, knowing what plants you can bring in your house. I just was in one of the big box stores the other day, and they had packaged up with a red ribbon around it, sago palms. And this was actually something that a listener several months brought to my attention. Very toxic for dogs. And yet there they are, no warning, whatever, just sitting there. So you know what you're bringing into your house, and, you know, keeping food and rich products out of the way. I like to make sure that everybody that has a dog has access to a chocolate toxicity calculator. They're free of charge. If you've got a smartphone, you can download the Chalk Tox calculator. So if your dog does happen to get into that box of delicious truffles or whatever, you can maybe estimate how much chocolate they had, how much your pet weighs, maybe what kind of chocolate it was, and, you know, figure out, is this something I really need to be concerned about? But that's why veterinarians are there too, because we can do the math and tell you better get in.
Yeah.
Sometimes you really have no idea how much they actually ingested.
It's dogs, not cats, for chocolate?
Cats can still have the same problem, but they tend to be a little more discriminating when it comes to eating things that they shouldn't. So we don't tend to see a lot of food toxicity problems in cats.
Sue in Mequon has a question. Hi, Sue. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering about walking my dogs in the winter. I can't figure out, is it too cold to walk them? Is it too cold to walk them at 30, 20, 10?
Again, it's really going to depend on the age of the dog, the health status of the dog, if they're elderly or very young, or perhaps have some type of health issue like heart disease, which is going to impair their perfusion or blood flow to the peripheral, you know, parts of their body, ear tips, tails, and so on. that could potentially aggravate exposure to cold and make them get colder even faster. So it's not an easy thing to answer. I think it comes down to knowing your dog. If you're seeing them picking up their feet, acting uncomfortable, then that's the time to say, hey, we better cut our walk short. Make it short and maybe just have a short route and then repeat that route again if your pet's still looking like they're active and happy. I had somebody in this morning that was in for an appointment and was asking me about getting booties for their dogs. And my advice with that, since the majority of dogs won't wear them, I look at dog booties as kind of like the fruitcake of the world, okay? We always joke that there's one fruitcake going around and people just keep passing it on. Dog booties are kind of like that. Very few stores will allow you to return them because the majority of dogs don't like wearing them. So know what your dog likes. If they will wear like little baby socks or something, then maybe invest in a better, more waterproof, durable boot for your dog to wear. But, don't be surprised if they don't like them. So I wish I could answer your question, but it's going to depend on whether there's salt down, wind chill, how low your dog is to the ground, how much hair they have between their toes. It's individual. And, you know, I walked in today and everybody's complaining of the cold, but here, you know, it's been a long time since I've lived in Canada, but I'm a Canadian and it's like, you know how to dress for it. I'm wearing long johns and boots and turtlenecks and fleeces and so on. And it's like, yeah, this is nothing, you know? So, and it's the same with certain dogs. You really have to know their tolerance. So I hope that you can get your dog out for some exercise, but it may be abbreviated, especially on these really cold days.
Good luck, Sue. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And sounds like Sue's dog is looking for some attention there.
I know. I can hear it barking in the background. Yeah.
Dana in Edgerton. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'd like Sandy to discuss the dangers of blastomycosis, especially in northern Wisconsin. My brother lost his dog after a vacation there last year.
Yeah, it is something. It is a fungal disease, blastomycosis, that we have in our state. The organism is not transmissible dog to dog, but once it's in the soil and can get into the infective stage, that's the area that we're going to, have dogs get exposed to because they've got their nose to the ground and it's patchy. It's not everywhere. It may be more prevalent in hunting dogs, dogs that are digging, rather than the dog that just wants to sit on the deck and do nothing. But it is a very nasty disease to have to deal with because it's long-term treatment. It can affect the brain. It can affect the eyes, the lungs, the skin. And treatment can be quite expensive and, like I said, lengthy as well. So, if you have a dog that starts developing a cough or a non-healing wound or, has an eye that's inflamed, that's always on our, on the back of our mind that this is a dog from Wisconsin. Potentially we could be dealing with a fungal infection and we're always on the lookout for it.
I had it and I did not. It
is
no fun.
Oh, yeah. It is no fun. And you're lucky because some dogs, if you don't catch it soon enough, you think, maybe they've got kennel cough or maybe they've got pneumonia and you're throwing things like antibiotics at them. That's not going to work. And this just keeps getting worse. And, we see many dogs not make it through treatment.
Yeah.
Yeah, this dog was misdiagnosed with pneumonia.
Yeah. And that's very, very common. So it needs to be on the veterinarian's radar. The farther south you go, the less you think of it. And so it's important that when you do take your pet into the vet for an illness, make sure they know your travel history because there are diseases and things that we see down south that we don't have up here. There's tick-borne diseases and so on that are more prevalent in certain parts of the country. And that's very important for us to be able to have that information so that it helps us kind of flush out our rule out list when we're looking at the symptoms the dogs may have.
Yeah, thanks, Dana. Appreciate it very much. Judy in Grand Marsh. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you so much for your show. What are the dangers of sugar-free gum that my dog sometimes might be looking for in the basket when he occasionally gets in there for tissues?
Oh, well, first of all, it really depends on the type of gum you use. If it contains something like sorbitol or NutraSweet or something like that, it's probably not going to be an issue. The real problem we run into is more and more gum manufacturers are using a sweetener kind of substitute called xylitol. For us, it's very harmless, but for dogs, extremely toxic. It's very unique to dogs, but what we'll see is, you know, just a couple of sticks of gum, and even gum that has been chewed, there may still be some residue of xylitol in it. So it really takes very, very little gum ingestion. What dogs will do is develop liver complications, but probably the thing that prompts the owner to say, I need to take them to the vet, is their blood sugar level drops and they become severely hypoglycemic and can start to seizure and without emergency therapy can die. So, you know, be really careful. You don't want to leave a pack of gum sitting on the dashboard of your car, in a, you know, access to your purse or anything like that, and be a label reader. And xylitol is showing up in many other things as well. So if you have a pet, that's one of those things that you really should probably avoid having in your house.
Is that for cats too, or
no? Dogs.
Just
yeah,
dogs.
It's a very unique concern for dogs. Just like, you know, why are Asiatic lilies toxic and put cats into kidney failure, but not dogs? You know, it's the same. It's just individual variations between the breeds and species, I should say. Yep.
How would a dog show he was hypoglycemic?
They usually get really weak. They may be disoriented and then proceed into having seizures and becoming unconscious and dying. So it's a progression that we see like that. I had an owner in that came upon the fact that their dog ate a package of gum, and they're like, well, let's just look it up just in case. And during the time that they were online looking up, sugarless gum toxicity with xylitol, the dog started to show some symptoms. Thank goodness they were only 2-3 blocks from the vet school. They were able to get the dog in and get it treated. If they were any further away, that dog may not have made it. And that's just in the time that they took from the dog ingesting it to getting online. And, you know, maybe they better go with a higher speed, internet connection. But that was enough for the dog to start showing symptoms.
Yeah. Shouldn't that be enough for a warning to be on the package?
Oh, you got it. But, you know, if that was the case, boy, you know, just think with, again, it's I think it should be, just like the issue with the sago palms and Easter lilies and things like that. I really think there should be warnings on all of those types of products. But that's the important part of being a pet parent, is doing your homework, looking up, you know, and there's websites all over the place with, you know, toxic foods, what not to use, what not to have in your house, toxic plants, and, you know, knowing what pets you have and what you can have in your house. Like, I know I love avocado, but I have my birds will sometimes be on my, you know, kitchen counters and table, and avocado is toxic to birds. So, you know, I have to be really careful that I don't have avocado around when my birds are out and about in the kitchen with me. So, and you know, with me having, you name the species, I have to be really careful with what I have in my home.
Judy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Vet Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Net as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Larry Mueller here. Thank you very much for listening in. Really appreciate all your calls and questions. And speaking of questions, Dwight in Duluth is with us with a question. Dwight, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I've got a comment about the dog booties.
Mm-hmm.
We have a schnoodle and a miniature poodle, and when it gets cold out, you know, they're lifting their legs and walking on three and stuff. You can tell they're really uncomfortable. They don't want to walk around. So my wife is a prolific rummage sailor, and she found these booties that look like balloons.
Okay, yes,
and I'll
yes.
I'll tell you what, we put those on, and the dogs go out, and they're, like, doing flips. They're
wonderful.
And they never come off, and they have wore unbelievably well. I don't know the name of them, but they are they're the best.
I have Absolutely. Seen those. And, you know, the ones that I've seen some people find success with are the ones that kind of have Velcro around the top. But the fact that you mentioned two breeds of dogs that typically go to the groomers and have their feet handled and have the hair taken off of them. If you tried putting booties on one of my bulldogs, okay, which I only have one right now, but anyways, that's a different story. There is absolutely no way. You'd maybe get one on and it would be off before you even got to the other foot. So
that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Once you roll these on, they stay on and they're actually very easy to put on. And the dogs don't seem to mind putting them on at all.
Well, I thank you for that. And just make sure they're not on too tight because, you know, if they do have that kind of real tight band at the top, that could interfere with blood supply to the feet. So I know they come in different sizes. Get the right size for your dog.
Thank you, Dwight.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Jan in Wales, hello to you. Jan, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am. Thanks. I'm just actually getting back into my car. Love public radio. Got to say that right off the bat.
Thank you.
This show. So my question, and your timing is perfect. We're leaving for a 17-hour car trip from from Wisconsin to North Carolina with two 12-year-old feral cats. One of them was recently diagnosed with diabetes, but it was very low levels of that. I think the blood glucose was like 400.
That's still up there. That's still up there. Yes. Okay. And you're going to be taking your cats with them? You're taking your cats with you?
Cats in the car.
Okay.
Two cat carriers. My question is, you know, there's so many pros and cons about feeding them or not feeding them, having empty stomachs, having full stomachs. I'm wondering how the diabetic cat, who is not on insulin, and since we put them on no-carb cat food, it's like a whole new person.
Okay.
The neuropathy is gone. He's full of energy. He's affectionate. He's happy. His tail is up. He's lost weight, which he needed to. So can he go all day without eating? And what is your opinion about feeding on a trip?
Yeah, well, I think we can approach this a couple of ways. Cats are very set in their ways. And anytime you start changing their routine, such as putting them in a car for many hours and changing where they're going to be staying, is going to be very stressful for them. And that could be enough to...
And the owner.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So my recommendation is unless they absolutely have to travel with you, you would be better off to have them, you know, staying in your home and having a pet sitter come in and care for them. That is
We're moving.
Oh, well, you have no choice then. Okay. So the concerns that I always have is, are they going to be drinking enough? When you have a cat that's a diabetic, that is not perfectly well regulated, they're going to be producing more urine because they're spilling sugar in their urine. And if they are scared because they're in the car, they may not want to drink much to be able to stay hydrated, and that can spiral them out of control. And this is the same for cats that have kidney disease or anything that throws off their water balance. And so when you stress them, that could potentially be a problem. As you know, when we have cats that are diabetics, especially cats that are on insulin, you have to be on a pretty strict feeding schedule to be able to help maintain that blood sugar level. Now, your cat is just being, at this point, managed medically, and I hope that works. It does for a small number of cats, just changing their diet, but some cats still need to be on insulin, so make sure that you're going in for, you know, regular blood sugar checks and so on. You may want to talk to your veterinarian about giving, especially the diabetic cat, a bolus, if his heart's normal, of subcutaneous fluids. This is what we do frequently with cats that may not be, they're not feeling well for some reason, and we have to keep their hydration status up, is rather than going with IV fluids when they have all this loose skin, we can kind of turn them into a big camel with a big, you know, hump on their back with fluids that will provide them with a source of hydration throughout the day. And that is even something that your veterinarian may be able to show you how to do. I would make sure that you also have along with you, emergency vet clinics on your way down there in case you have a cat that starts getting ill. maybe even have a few little trial car trips to see if a short trip, whether they'll eat their favorite food in the car. But I think, you know, trying to maintain their schedule as much as you can while they're in the car is probably the most important thing. And I'm really concerned about, you know, what's going to happen going down there. So, boy, I think sub-Q fluids may be a really good thing for the diabetic cat.
Yeah.
Now, we're leaving at 2:30 in the morning.
Okay.
When can the fluids be given and how long do they last?
Well, this would be something that your veterinarian can show you how to do. And it's going to depend on whether the cat is drinking or not drinking. But it takes several hours for them to be absorbed. And it may be something that, you know, if you're going to be, you know, stopping along the way, having fluids along with you so that you can administer them. Cats, owners that have cats with these chronic diseases like kidney disease and diabetes become very adept at doing this with their cats. And most cats are very tolerant of it. There's a wonderful website that has a pictorial thing on how to give fluids to cats, and it's feline CRF. It stands for chronicrenalfailure.com.
Okay.
Feline CRF.
Okay.
And if you go into treatment, they will have some things in there with, you know, how to give fluids. And I'd work with your veterinarian to see if that is something that would be feasible for your cat.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's really helpful. Great. Well,
okay.
Thank you so
Good
much.
Luck with the move.
Yeah.
Feeding in general, just offer it to them a couple times. I mean, yeah. My suspicion is they won't touch it.
They're
going to be very, very unhappy.
Yeah. And since they are, if the cat was on insulin, I'd be more concerned. But the fact that the cat isn't on insulin is, you know, you're not going to see those wild fluctuations in the blood sugar that you may if he's not eating and getting insulin. So I, you know, you may be okay with that, with, you know, offering it to them. But if they don't eat, oh well, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that it's the water that I'm really concerned about.
Good luck, Jan.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Laura in Milwaukee, who has a cat that was recently treed by the neighbor's dog. He suffered a leg wound that we decided to treat at home, making progress. We continue to flush it out with saline solution and wash with antimicrobial soap. My question is, the wound is no longer infected, is beginning to heal, but still open. Should we be letting him lick that area?
Oh, oral bacteria is probably the thing that, you know, that old wives' tale of a pet licking their wound is going to make it heal faster is absolutely false. There's bacteria there. The rough surface of the cat's tongue is enough to take some of those new cells that are starting to grow and close the wound. They're going to be stripping those away. So I would be looking at getting an Elizabethan collar for your cat. You can get them either in a plastic form, or many cats seem to appreciate a fabric type e-collar, and they're available at pet stores, and you can either use a small dog size or one that's designed for cats as well, and that may allow that wound to heal, but there are times where it may not heal, and you're going to have to look at, you know, closure afterwards, where you've got it shrunk down as much as you can, but the body's like, nope, we're just going to be letting it sit like this, and that's where sometimes, after you've kind of gone through all this, surgical intervention may be necessary. So get the e-collar and, you know, work with your veterinarian, even if it's just like taking photos of the wound so they can have a look at it. And, you know, we do this all the time, and somebody will say, hey, what do you think of this? And I'm like, I think what needs to be seen, or, you know, maybe, they're looking pretty mild. You know, just keep working on it at home. So I think, you know, working with your vet that way may be helpful and answer some of your questions too.
John in Rice Lake, hello.
Hello. Say, we have a 12-year-old Pompu, and she's been diagnosed with collapsing esophagus, and it's been getting progressively worse now. It started out where she'd cough once or twice and it'd be fine, but now when she wakes up in the morning or comes in from outside or just gets up off the floor, she goes into these coughing spells that just continue on for quite a while. What can we expect in her condition as it goes on? I guess my concern is, at what point do we, you know, call it quits or something, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, how do we know?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I don't think your dog has a collapsing esophagus. The esophagus is the tube that connects the mouth to the stomach, and okay. It is a flattened tube unless food's going through there. What I think is probably going on with your dog is what's called collapsing trachea. The trachea, or the windpipe, if you feel your own neck, you can feel all those little rings of cartilage, which gives it its shape and its form and keeps it open so we can continue to get air in and out easily. Some, especially small breed dogs, have issues with the cartilaginous rings being very weak. And then if they get excited, exert themselves, and they're trying to breathe in deeply, the trachea can absolutely, you know, snap shut and collapse down and impair their ability to get air in and out, which is what reason why they get the cough that's associated with this. You know, a couple of the things that we always want to do is, one, keep your dog slender. If your dog is overweight, that extra weight, besides on the outside in the body, is on the inside as well, surrounding that airway, and that can aggravate it. Making sure that you don't use a regular collar on your dog when you're walking them. You know, if you need to walk your dog for exercise, use a harness instead, so all the pressure is taken off of the neck and is around the thoracic cavity rather than around the neck. You know, there are some surgical interventions that can be done where they can put in tracheal stents. And, you know, most people don't go that route, but just know that that is available if you were to work with, you know, a surgeon that, you know, is a specialist when it comes to dealing with kind of oddball surgeries like that. Sometimes what we have to put these dogs on is, you know, things like bronchodilators, sometimes cough suppressants, because once they get coughing, it just becomes this vicious cycle. The more they cough, the more it collapses, which makes it cough even more. So that would be something to, again, talk to your veterinarian about. Or, you know, is there something medically that we can do to be able to make our dog feel more comfortable? And you'd be looking at probably lifetime medication. But, you know, you brought up the topic of, you know, when do you call it quits with a pet? And I just found this quote, and believe it or not, it's from Ann Landers, and it really hit home. And I cut it out and brought it in because I figured someone may ask that question today. And this is what she said. She said, some people believe that holding on and hanging in there are signs of great strength. However, there are times when it takes much more strength to know when to let go and then do it. And she's not talking about ending a pet's life, but that's the way I looked at it. Mm-hmm. You know, if your dog may be uncomfortable, but this is something that you have to look at the big picture. Is, you know, are they still finding joy in life? Are they still interested in what's going on around them? And is this something that, with drugs that aren't that expensive, you can get your dog feeling better and coughing less, and, you know, making some management changes like I talked about before. And I hope with that you can have your dog for a long, long time, because for a small breed dog, it's not that old.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
No?
Good. Well, great to hear. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, John. Thank you for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Ron in Grand Marais, Minnesota. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I have a question on a couple of vaccinations. I have a 3-year-old lab, and I get her vaccinated for all the regular things. But I wondered specifically on, is it necessary to get vaccinations for parainfluenza and hepatitis? And do you do that yearly or every 3 years? And how do they catch those things?
Oh, good questions. Okay. Well, first of all, hepatitis in dogs is a disease that's out there. Have I ever diagnosed it? Probably not in my career, but it's because we have the majority of the population vaccinated, but we know that it still exists and it still shows up in certain areas, like large cities and so on, where you may have a lot more stray dogs. We don't, majority of people, veterinarians, don't vaccinate for the actual hepatitis bug, which is called adenovirus 1. You may still find some vaccines available at like pet stores and Farm and Fleet and so on that have that in it, but we've identified that particular virus can cause an eye problem in dogs that's nicknamed blue eye, where their cornea becomes almost a bluish color and can lead to permanent visual problems. What we have been using for many, many years is a sister or brother virus to adenovirus 1 called adenovirus 2. That is cross-protects for hepatitis. And so it's a little complicated, but I'm a purist when it comes to using that hepatitis word, because hepatitis isn't recommended, but adenovirus 2 is one of those diseases that we look at as a core vaccine for dogs. All dogs should be vaccinated. But because it's a virus, we can do it less frequently than we can some of the other vaccines like leptospirosis and Lyme vaccine and kennel cough with Bordetella, because those are bacteria. We can get by with vaccinating every 3 years with that. That's the national guidelines. And, you know, it may even provide longer term immunity than that. Parainfluenza is sometimes also included in the injectable vaccine, but you may also see it in the intranasal vaccines that are used for vaccinating for kennel cough. And it does cause not only a systemic disease, but also a respiratory problem in dogs. And for the, you know, that's probably, you know, more lifestyle dependent and is not listed as what's called a core vaccine that every dog needs, just because it's not that severe a disease. But if you've got a dog that's boarding, going to doggy daycare, going to the dog park, it would be a good idea to keep that up, because they get them from contact with nasal secretions and respiratory secretions from other pets. So, you know, that one, not probably necessary if you've got a household pet that never goes out or sees other dogs. But if your dog's leading a pretty normal social life, should be kept up with that. And that's usually with the kennel cough vaccine, and it's given, like I said, nasally. And because it's linked with Bordetella, that has to be given every year.
Okay, great.
Thanks. Does that help? Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Kyla, who has a kitten that year old that tends to eat tissue out of the box, but has also eaten cough drop sugar-free wrappers. We haven't noticed them coming out whole when cleaning the kitty box. How bad is this to her?
Well, the question is, why has this cat developed this pica, or abnormal eating disorder? And it may be truly behavioral, but just to give you an example of a case where we have we had a cat that the owner noticed them, had never done this before, started eating the cat litter that was not like wheat-based litter or corn-based litter, but actually the clay litter that was scattered outside the litter box, just going around and licking it up. We got the cat in for a physical, and it turned out the cat was severely anemic and was infected with feline leukemia. Why it's eating something weird, I have no idea, but we always want to make sure that that pet's healthy and happy and doesn't have something like some underlying intestinal problem where they're ingesting this stuff because it might temporarily make them feel good. It may just be that the cat likes the mouthfeel. I'd be making sure that you have covered waste baskets, that you maybe keep the you know, tissue box in a cabinet away from your cat. Although it's unlikely to cause an obstruction, it potentially could, and if your cat were to eat enough of it. So it comes down to changing how you maintain your house. I used to have a cat that loved ribbon, anything with ribbon on it. If you got helium balloons with ribbon on it, he'd know that's right in the house, and he would be, you know, trying to find it to eat it, which can really be a problem for cats because it can cause what's called a linear foreign body. So I think that getting your cat, if it hasn't been checked out, get a good physical exam, make sure everything's normal, maybe get a little bit of blood work, and then just, you know, if it's chalked up as a behavior problem, change your household so that you can live with your cat comfortably.
Sue in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I was wondering if you could review the reasons why you do not give your family a pet on Christmas Day.
Well, pets should never be given as gifts anyways, because the person who's receiving it should be the one that decides the right time, the right place, the right breed, the right size, all of those things. We see so many mismatched pet owner situations. You know, and Christmas one, I mean, I think people have to have their head examined to adopt a puppy in the middle of winter. At least I wouldn't, because going out and housebreaking them when it's, you know, below zero is pretty miserable. But, you know, that is the time when there's so much other stuff going on that, you know, the pet becomes at risk of injury, you know, being ignored, being, you know, overstimulated. And it's just not a, you know, a good time to be able to do that. But I have a story, my own story of when I was young, much younger, obviously, you know, under 10 years of age, I wanted hamsters. And I asked my family to get me hamsters. And so my parents went out and thought they were getting a boy and a girl hamster. Stupid, because it would make more hamsters. But and they kept all of our, you know, the Christmas gifts, obviously, that Santa couldn't deliver. You know, they kept at my grandparents' house. And guess what? One of the hamsters got out on Christmas Eve, and they had to tear my grandmother's house apart to be able to find it. They did find it in the linen closet, put it back in the cage. My dad brought the cage home. Turned out it was not a male and a female. It was two males. They fought. I wake up as a 7 or 8 year old to a dead hamster and one that's injured that didn't live very long. Talk about the worst Christmas morning of your life. But that, you know, although that's, you know, extreme, those are the kind of things that can happen that can, you know, really ruin a family vacation or family time together. So if you want to get an owner a pet, get them maybe a leash and a collar to say, when everything's settled down, let's go out and we're going to get one of these together. You know, if it's a cat, maybe get them a scratching post or something that is a reminder that, okay, we after the holidays can go out and get a pet. And yeah, I think that just makes sense for everybody.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you, Sue. Good reminder. Brianna in Appleton. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me.
What's on your mind?
I have in my family a three-legged Staffy Terrier. He's 7 now, and we try to walk him very regularly. He loves his walks, but we have a very large house, and it's not always convenient for us to walk him outside in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
What can I be doing for him inside? I mean, he loves playing tug, but he's not always a fetch dog. What can I do to keep him exercised regularly?
Oh, you know, and that can sometimes be tough if you've, you know, it really depends on the dog's, you know, desire to play. I know right now my bulldog, that's her big thing is playing tug. And it gets old after a while of me sitting there while, you know, dragging her around the house with her toy in her mouth and she
drives me around.
Yeah, and you know, she's happy, but it's like, I got to get stuff done. And it would be really nice if I could just sit there and throw a toy and read or watch television or make dinner or whatever and have her get her exercise. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think physical exercise, boy, I mean, they do make things like doggy treadmills that you could work on. You may find, I mean, I've had some dogs that really love laser pointers, even though, you know, it tends to be more of a cat toy. Some dogs would like to go after things like that.
Okay.
So it's knowing your dog and being inventive. There's lots of very cool kind of interactive dog toys now that dispense food that require the dog to move things around, because as they push the ball or the, you know, the toy, once in a while a piece of food may come out, and that may be enough to keep them mentally stimulated as well as getting a little bit of physical activity. But good for you for realizing that a dog with three legs, when it's snowy and everything, it may be tough for them to be able to get around.
And I have one more question. I also have, it's a very busy household. I have two kittens, both under the age of 6 months. So it's just a flurry of activity. And I'd like to not declaw them. I've heard a lot of controversial things about declawing or not declawing cats and what it does to them long term. Do you have any doctoral advice about declawing cats or not?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in the same boat where, you know, I think it is something that is going to depend on whether, like, who is living at home with the kittens. If you've got someone who's on blood thinners because, you know, they're on Coumadin or something, then that could potentially be a problem. If you've got a very young child at home, it may be a problem. I mean, I always counsel people, use, you know, get scratching posts, teach them how to trim the nails, you know, plastic nail caps, all of those things. But there are times where doing all of that, it fails. And You know, and so I would, you know, if declawing is the way of keeping that cat in the house where they're going to be safe, they're going to have a family for the rest of their life, that would be, you know, I think then that's logical to do that rather than seeing the an owner give the cat up because of my principles. I think declawing is one of those surgeries that can be done safely. It is a surgery that requires pain management before, you know, during and after, and, you know, does require some management changes when you get home with cat litter. And one of the sad statistics, though, is that when you start looking at percentage of declawed cats, they're supposed to stay inside because they've lost defense mechanisms. 60% of declawed cats become indoor-outdoor cats. And that's just wrong. Okay, so that's one of
terrible.
My... Isn't that terrible? You know, and so...
We'd like our cats to be able to take walks with us. We've researched all sorts of harnesses that work well for cats, and... That's not an option.
Okay. Well, good. And make sure that you do talk to your veterinarian if your cat's going to be an outdoor cat, even on a harness. Heartworm control, flea and tick control, intestinal parasite control, all those things are going to be necessary.
Okay. I didn't even think of the blood thinners thing. That's a very good point. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
And Brianna.
Okay. Thank you so much for your information.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
And, all right. Have a good day.
Yeah. To you as well. Pam and Superior, we'll get to you in just a second. Just a reminder, our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Vet Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. And you can join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Pam in Superior has a question for you, Sandy. Hi, Pam. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My son has a 4-year-old beagle, and every month or so, he goes into horrible, agonizing howling, and this can go on for hours. And they've said, oh, I think it's because he's eaten bread. He crawls under the bed and cries. It's horrible. I have a beagle also, and he doesn't do that. So,
and have they taken him to a vet clinic to have this evaluated?
Yeah. No, they said he's a wimp.
Oh, well, you know, if he's normal at home all the time, except for these episodes, there's something seriously going on with him. And we can see dogs crying out for pain. We can see them if they're fearful of something. They may be, you know, whimpering or crying. But if he's acting uncomfortable, it's changing the way he socializes with the family. You know, that could be anything from a chronic disc disease or something, and we do see beagles get some neurologic issues. It potentially could be gastrointestinal distress, but I really think it needs to be looked into. If they can't transport the dog during these episodes, again, getting it on video so they can see, is the dog hunched over? Is the dog shaking its, you know, like moving its head normally? There's different, is it limping? Is it showing some other, you know, symptoms so we can start localizing where the pain is occurring? But even if the dog's a wimp, and I don't know whether the veterinarian said that or...
No, they said that, and he just shakes.
Okay.
My dog sat him one day through one of these episodes, and if he were mine, he would have been at the emergency.
Yeah, and I think that's what needs...
Awful.
Yeah, that's, I think, what needs to be done, and the next time you're babysitting that happens, just... go for it, okay?
Yeah.
The dog needs to be looked at. I really can't tell you what's going on. I mean, it could even be some kind of bizarre seizure disorder. So I think any of those things, you know, need to be evaluated. And getting him in when he's in one of these episodes is important because if he's not showing symptoms between episodes, it would be hard to diagnose.
Yep.
Okay, I'll tell him to film it.
Okay.
Yep. All right. Thank you, Pam.
Okay. Thank you.
Why would you not just take it?
I know. I think, you know, it's like, but, you know, when you start looking at, you know, especially in cats, there was a study that was just recently published by the Bayer Company and the American Association of Feline Practitioners that were looking at why 52% of cat owners avoid regular veterinary care. And believe it or not, 63% of cats in cat-only households that never go outside, so the owners think they never need veterinary care. And they're not susceptible to disease.
Oh.
So you know, and I know that that's not true, that 81% of their cats think that their cat's in excellent health. And yet I don't remember a cat coming in that I've said, I can't find anything wrong with it for so long, whether it be dental disease, an ear infection, obesity, something is wrong with them. And that, you know, a lot of people feel that their cat just hates going to the vet. You can go to, there's a website called thecatalystcouncil.org that has all kinds of great tips on how to get your cat to the vet. And although this was a dog owner, you know, cats seem to be the ones that don't go to the vet as often. And we need to get them in and get them checked out because they're so good at hiding symptoms.
Amanda in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, I have two cats, and one is about 7 years old, and the other one's about 3 years old. And the problem was with the older cat. A few months ago, he just kind of went crazy in the middle of the night and started attacking our other cat. And we've taken him to the vet, and they've checked for bladder crystals. We've taken him to the vet three times, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, he hasn't been, it seems like he's having trouble going to the bathroom, and we took him to the vet again, and they checked his anal glands, and they checked his bladder again, and they just keep telling us that it's a behavioral issue, but I'm wondering, he just doesn't seem, like, right. He's scared all the time, and it just seems such a sudden thing, but I was wondering if there's something else we could ask them to check about.
I mean, how good of you to go in and be, one, observant that your cat may be having some elimination issues, and to get them in and have them checked out. You know, a thorough physical exam is always important. You know, baseline lab work, checking a thyroid level, although a seven-year-old cat, we don't see hyperthyroidism in them that often, but that can definitely cause some kind of anxious type behavior as well. And we're seeing thyroid issues in cats kind of earlier and earlier. So that might be something, if your vet doesn't have that on the radar, to have that looked into. What you're describing, though, this sudden out of the blue attacking the other cat, is not as uncommon as you think. We see a problem, an aggression problem in cats called redirected aggression. You know, so I'll just paint a scenario. I don't know if this is what happened or not, but you've got your cat sleeping in bed quietly, doing fine. You know, nothing's going on. The seven-year-old is sitting back by the back patio, and all of a sudden, a stray cat that tends to be out more at night shows up in their window and scares your cat. And they get into this, like, I want to attack you mode, but then take off into the bedroom, jump up on the bed, wake up your other cat. The seven-year-old's in this agitated state. The other one's like, oh my God, why are you so agitated? And boom, they start fighting. And so they can start taking it out on each other, even though the victim, the three-year-old, maybe had nothing to do with it. So sometimes we just never know exactly what the trigger was. But if the cats are still really uncomfortable around each other, I'd be making sure that you keep them separate. And if there's nothing wrong physically with the seven-year-old cat, maybe consider medical management for an anxiety disorder. But often reintroducing them after they've had a break from each other very, very slowly, and it can take weeks to months, may help. But that's the kind of the path I would go down.
And we have done that. We've separated them for long periods of time. This has been since maybe like late August, September, and it was when windows were open. So we thought maybe he like smelled another cat through the window or heard him or something. But he we keep them separated for a really long time, and then we reintroduce them slowly. And then something will set him off again, and we just
And that's the problem, is whatever is causing the seven-year-old to get upset. And it may be a noise, it may be a smell, it may be seeing another cat, and then your three-year-old is the victim. it's possible that these two cats may not be able to live together. And it's also possible that medical management may be able to help the 7-year-old cat, or may be able to help the 3-year-old cat be a little bolder and be able to stand, you know, stand his ground. So it may have to be approached both ways. But working with an applied animal behaviorist may be very helpful if your veterinarian is unable to, you know, kind of work with psychoactive drugs and be able to help you that way.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Becky in Monona, Iowa. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, hi, good morning. I have a 9-year-old Pomeranian mix that was recently diagnosed with chronic renal disease or chronic renal failure.
Yeah.
And he had a blood panel done, and he's also anemic and... there's lots of things. He's got lots of things going on. But can you tell me what is what should I look for? I mean, like he doesn't eat very well. I had a hard time getting him to eat. But in the morning, I will notice he will tremble.
Yeah.
Not like a seizure. And I don't know what that is.
Well, if he's just not feeling well, if he's got, you know, secondary gastritis from having kidney toxin values up. But, you know, things that you're going to be wanting to have your veterinarian look at is he spilling a lot of protein in his urine? Sometimes we can help them and buy them more time with drugs that help with that. So doing a specific test for urine protein levels, checking blood pressure, I think would be really helpful because that may be making them feel not well as well. And a lot of dogs with kidney disease also have elevated blood pressure. Consider getting an abdominal ultrasound done. Your dog is very young to be in kidney failure. It's typically an old animal thing. And for a pom, I mean, they're just really in middle age right now as being a 9-year-old. And that may be able to show, do you have some like congenital kidney problems or maybe a kidney stone or something that is, you know, causing all this to be a problem for your dog. So a little more diagnostics may be helpful. But I think probably one of the best places to go for information on staging and managing kidney disease in dogs is a website called IRIS. It's International Renal Interest Society. If you just do IRIS, I-R-I-S, that will pop up, IRIS Kidney. And they've got stuff on there for you and veterinarians and all things that need to be monitored and followed up with your dog. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Sorry as well, ma'am. I thank you very much for calling, and a good luck to you. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then she will be right back. Stay with us. Just as with human health concerns, it can be stressful when your pet is ill, and with so much information out there, sometimes one thing contradicts another. It can be hard to know where to turn. Larry Mueller here. Once a month, we have a chance to turn to Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She's with us today. Dr. Sandy, great, as always, to have you along.
It's so nice to be here.
We have lots of callers online. We've been getting lots of email and Facebook questions. We have an email from Deborah in La Crosse, whose dog is just 5 pounds. And she can't get him to poop outside in the snow. Any ideas? I shovel a path to the grass and cleaned off an area and still no poop. I'm afraid he's going to get sick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and this can be a problem for especially small breed dogs where the snow is higher than them. I think in this situation, looking at investing in an indoor potty system for your dog would probably be a good idea. They make lots of different ones, everything from a dog litter box, and it's not that dogs seek out litter to be able to use it like a cat does. They want a substrate they can dig in, but it's just a location that becomes okay, and it requires you training your dog that, you know, as soon as you know that they have just eaten, that they may need to go, taking them over to a, you know, the potty pads, or they make these like grass systems that some of them even come with like fake fire hydrants and so on that the dog is able to use may be helpful. If you've got a garage, sometimes just having their feet on colder concrete may be enough to help them. But It is a problem. I know even my dog this morning kind of poked her head out the dog door and then backed up and went back to bed. And I'm like, okay, you know, she's going to hold it for a while. But you're doing the right thing with, keeping the snow shoveled, just frequent little trips outside if you can. But, you know, seriously look into that indoor potty. It's, you know, I don't usually recommend them, but in a little dog like this, it may be necessary.
An email from Michael in La Crosse who wondered what might be common symptoms among various dog breeds if they've ingested sidewalk or street salt used to melt snow.
Yeah, if they're licking their feet and come, and, you know, the things that I worry about are, you know, other toxins, antifreeze and so on that also may be on their feet. But salt can be very irritating to the intestinal tract. And if a pet ingests too much salt, they can actually develop some neurologic toxicity, salt toxicity. It would take an awful lot of salt to have that happen. Uh-huh. But it's, you know, so it's, you know, a good idea. That's where booties, if your dog will wear them. If you're treating your own property, they do make pet safe salt substitutes that work very well, aren't irritating nor causing any toxicity problems too. But they're expensive compared to regular rock salt, so you're not going to see, you know, street crews or city sidewalk crews using that type of product. So washing your pet's feet when they come in, that would be probably your best preventive measure.
And Bob emailed, and one of our cats used to meow all the time, but now it only gives out an ack sound when trying to meow. The vet is baffled, but after checking her out, she says it's okay. She doesn't seem to be in any distress, still tries to vocalize, even getting out a regular meow once in a while. It's getting old, 13.
Yeah, I have no idea. I think you could, if you really wanted to look into this, getting a laryngeal exam where the cat would be under a light plane of anesthesia. You would get the tongue, you know, kind of extract a little bit from the mouth and go in with a laryngoscope and actually watching those vocal cords moving to make sure that the cat doesn't have either a vocal cord paralysis or a polyp or another type of mass that could be causing the cat to have some issues with its voice. That may be possible. But, you know, I hear this, and sometimes we'll see cats that have had upper respiratory infections lose their meow, almost get laryngitis, but then get it back again. But being an older cat, I'd be looking at something probably structural in the laryngeal area. But you can't look at it in a wake cat. You really have to be looking at anesthesia to be able to have this done.
Lynette and Hubertus, thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I spoke with you last month, Dr. Sandy, regarding the emaciated beagle mix that the neighbors are taking care of. And about a week after that, I had witnessed just horrible pain, what appeared to be pain. Every single symptom that you mentioned regarding that other beagle that lady talked that called in before.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggested and tried to convince them to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't and can't. They just don't feel that they can. However, last week the vet came out to the house and gave her a low-dose steroid shot.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to have made a world of difference.
Okay.
And she seems to now be pooping normally. Her appetite has always been up, but her appetite is very good. And she's almost acting like a normal dog, where she'll scratch herself. She doesn't seem to be so neurologically disoriented and shaking as much anymore.
Good, good.
Is this or would this be the appropriate course of action?
Boy.
I guess once a month is what the vet said.
Yeah,
you can get this steroid shot.
Yeah, there isn't a steroid that's going to last a month. There's some of the longer acting steroids, maybe a week or two. But you know, I think, you know, throwing the silver bullet, which is sometimes what we refer to steroids, at a dog without having a diagnosis, you know, is that the correct thing to do? If you know, anytime someone, you know, a general citizen sees a pet in a situation where they're in pain, they're maybe not be getting the care that they need, you have the right of calling animal control and reporting this owner. Is it appropriate that this dog just get a steroid injection? I have no idea. I'd really have to talk to the veterinarian to find out what she found on physical exam, what they suspicious of, because, boy, there are steroids are going to decrease inflammation. They are going to boost the appetite a little bit. It may help with, some immune mediated diseases and things at the, appropriate doses. But it's, having this dog for the rest of their life on steroids is not going to be in the dog's best interest either. So I really think this needs to be evaluated. And if the owner doesn't want to do it, then maybe it's going to be up to you to say, well, let's get the authorities involved and have this dog handled appropriately. I know that seems a little harsh, especially if you're good friends with your neighbors, but we have to be thinking about the dog in this case.
Yeah, there you go.
One more thing. I did take video of her prior to the steroid shot, and I was wondering if I could send that to you and just perhaps...
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you can if you want to. My email address at the veterinary school. I think if Judith can just get it up on the Facebook page or something, that would be wonderful. Yep,
sure.
I'll watch for it.
All right, thank you, Lynette. We'll have that posted up on our Facebook page in just a matter of a few minutes. Judith, in her usual
okay,
efficient self, will handle that. Thank you again, Mike in La Crosse. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a question about a Borzoi. Mm-hmm. I have just about a 2-year-old Borzoi and about getting her spayed. And I had read that larger breeds, especially ones with long legs, if you get them spayed too early, that interferes with the hormones for growth and everything and can cause, a higher incidence of bone cancer in the dog.
There was a study that came out of UC Davis looking at golden retrievers that were spayed or neutered under a year of age or over a year of age. And they found that there were certain orthopedic diseases that we see at a higher rate in dogs that are spayed or neutered young than when they're older. But we do know that the life expectancy of a spayed or neutered pet in general is longer. Okay, so that is one of the advantages, is that they do live longer than an animal that's intact. If you're planning on using her for breeding, you need to have those reproductive organs. So if she's of a quality that you want to have her reproduce, then you're going to have to keep her intact. Some of the big risk for female dogs would be a breast cancer. She's already 2, and you're kind of at that magic point where if she's had a couple of heat cycles, the damage has already been done, and you need to be doing monthly breast exams on your dog to be checking for lumps or bumps, regardless of whether she's been bred or not. If you leave her intact, you really should be keeping a good diary of her heat cycles so that if she does develop a uterine infection, something called a pyometra, we're able to kind of link it back, because the symptoms can be very vague early on with a uterine infection. But if you come in and say, she was just in heat a month ago and now she's just not feeling good, she's got this little vaginal discharge, and she's not eating well, then we may be more inclined to start jumping in on that if we kind of know her history. So really keep close tabs on it. But she's full grown right now as a 2-year-old. So I think the benefits of letting her have that hormonal, stimulation of the bone to cause growth plate closure has already been done. So now you just have to start looking at all those other reasons that I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
So it would be to an advantage for having her live longer to get her spayed.
The statistics are that they do live longer, although there was a Rottweiler study. And so this is the problem. So we don't really have general information on everybody, and all the research is done, differently. But there was a Rottweiler study that showed that intact females actually live longer. Now, that was for Rottweilers. But in the general population, you're going to see, it's reported that spayed or neutered pets are going to have a longer life expectancy.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mike, for calling, and good luck with your decision, too. It's interesting. For me, I would, if you're not going to have... You're not going to have the dog bred. I'd be inclined to...
Yeah, to have them spayed or neutered. That's right.
Bob in Appleton. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello there.
What's on your mind? Yeah, go ahead.
I have a 15-year-old beagle mix that we've been battling with a bladder infection, ear infection for about 4 or 5 months, and we're on our third different dose of antibiotics. We've done x-rays. There's no stones. Everything seems to be okay. Just can't seem to shake it. And he's up 4 or 5 times throughout the night. Every 2 hours, he's got to go outside. And when he goes to the bathroom.
Okay.
I think it's pretty frequent.
Okay.
And we don't give him water after, let's say, 7 or 8 o'clock. And now the next thing they said, the vet said, well, we should probably do an ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, what will that tell him? If there's a kidney failure? And is an ultrasound cost? He said it'd cost about $600 or $700.
No, it's at the vet school, it's less than half of that. And even less than that if you just do a urinary tract ultrasound. So with what you have told me, if you came into my office and said, you know, I've got this dog that's up, it's a male. Is he neutered or not?
Yeah.
He's neutered, okay. Male dog that's up urinating more at night, and you said he's drinking more as well?
No, we don't. We cut him off the water because I got to get some sleep.
Yeah, but unfortunately, that could be a problem. If you've got some underlying health problem that's making him need to drink more, we don't want him to get dehydrated. But when I hear that kind of history, and what I would be looking at is, you know, do you really have a bladder infection? Getting a sterile urine sample, having it cultured to determine what the bacteria is, and that's been done?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And so you've got him, you've done the appropriate culture and sensitivity, had him on the right dose of an antibiotic to be able to get this under control. One of the things that I get worried about with male dogs is even if they're neutered, they can still run into troubles with prostate disease. They can get prostate cancer and so on, which can make it, you know, abnormal. So you can have, you know, bacteria and so on, sometimes living in areas like that.
Prostate exam, and they felt that was clean.
What did you say?
They did a prostate exam.
Okay.
That's okay.
Okay. And, you know, that's going to tell us whether it's enlarged or not, but it's not going to tell us what's going on inside of it. And that's where an ultrasound may be helpful. When we do an ultrasound, we're not only looking at the bladder wall for maybe stones that don't show up on a regular x-ray, because there are some that are like that. We look at bladder wall thickness. Being a 15-year-old dog, bladder wall tumors can be an issue, and so having that looked at, having a look at the prostate for prostatic cysts or abscesses, uncommon in neutered dogs, but you know, having a look for, you know, some abnormalities in the structure of the prostate, and also looking at the kidneys to see, do they look like, you know, old age kidney failure kidneys? Are they lumpy, bumpy, or, you know, they're shaped differently? They appear differently ultrasonographically. Those would all be things that would help paint the whole picture of what's going on with your dog. So, you know, if your vets, you know, jump through all the hoops of culturing and following up with culture with the antibiotics to make sure that, you know, they did get it all under control. And that's the problem when we have infections that are recurrent, is it because we have some underlying thing that's making it come back again, or did we just not treat long enough? Did we not treat with the right antibiotic? And so making sure that you're getting cultures done during treatment is also effective and or helpful, and sometimes right after treatment to make sure everything is clean as well. So these can be really complicated cases to deal with. I hope you can get to the bottom of it, but don't rule out getting an ultrasound done. It can be done, and it's actually not that expensive and reveals a lot of information that plain x-rays don't.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thanks, Bob, for calling. Kind of an emergency question here on Facebook from Jan, who says, my dog just jumped up on the counter spilling the meds I was sorting for my husband. He ate vitamins and a saw palmetto?
Not much sure what that is, but yeah.
Is this something I should treat with hydrogen peroxide to make him vomit?
Yeah, I would talk to your veterinarian. There are some things that a pet may eat that are going to be more irritating if you make them vomit up. So call your veterinarian right away or an emergency clinic to find out if that would be an appropriate thing for what your dog ate. They can help you with the dose of peroxide.
Apparently it's an herbal supplement.
It's an herbal supplement. And even herbal supplements can potentially potentially be toxic in the wrong, you know, if they're, because yeah. your dog's tiny compared to a human. So having that bottle on hand, if you are not wanting to call your veterinarian, there are poison control centers. There's one down in Illinois. There is a fee for it, but they would be able to help you as well. But I think definitely get on the phone because this it may be something that needs to be taken care of.
Heidi in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. We have a very small cat, and as much as we try to keep her away from sort of small wires with that kind of gummy plastic they create now,
mm-hmm.
and if, even on like your power cord, she finds it and eats it, and I've noticed some of it coming, her passing some of it. And it hasn't affected her energy level, but her shots are coming up, and I'm wondering if I should have the vet take an x-ray to make sure she doesn't have anything in her stomach that she hasn't.
I would, at this point, yeah, I mean, if she's not showing any symptoms, I would probably save your money, and because a lot of times plastic doesn't show up, because it, you're not going to, if it's not calcified or metallic, you may, if there's a big wad of foreign material in there, you may be able to see something in the stomach. But it's, you know, if she's asymptomatic, I'd say I would rather see you approach it from the standpoint of you know, addressing it as a pica, an abnormal eating behavior. Get a good physical exam done, maybe a little bit of lab work to make sure that there isn't anything physically going on with your kitty cat. And then approach it from changing the way your household is set up. You may have to have cords wound together and, you know, kept in, you know, conduit or something to be able to keep her from chewing at it. There, you know, the number of things like that, you may have to make some changes. Some cats that have these weird picas, you increase the amount of like plant material and fiber and things like that that they can have by providing them with kitty greens or chopped up bits of romaine lettuce or maybe a higher fiber diet. Some of them do well with that. And I've even had some cats that love to chew on things decide that it's okay to chew on the little tiny like rawhide sticks and things that they make for small dogs.
Oh,
and some cats love that, and it gives them that chewing action, and they start leaving your other things alone. So, you know, save your money on the x-ray. I probably wouldn't be doing it unless she's symptomatic.
Right.
Okay. When we first got her, they wanted a high protein diet. So right now she's on a wellness brand with wet food supplements. Would you change that to something with more fiber?
Yeah, and see, but cats are carnivores, and so a animal based protein diet is definitely preferred. But you know, there are cats out there that just to keep their GI tract healthy and happy need to have some fiber. There isn't a perfect food for every cat that's out there. It's up to you to find the one that's perfect for your cat.
All right.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, we got a photo here on our Facebook page and a question along with it from Tricia. Our adopted cat Stanley is about a year and a half and weighs 19 pounds, 8 ounces. He started the Royal Canine Satiety food about 2 months ago and has lost 6 ounces in this amount of time. He doesn't get treats or people food, fed twice a day, 3/4 of a cup total with a timed feeder.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what the reasonable expectation is for weight loss in terms of pounds as well as length of time it can take.
Yeah, we're looking at very slow, gradual weight loss, like 1-2% a week. I mean, very slow. So it can take a year or more to get that weight off. And how good of her to be approaching it with, you know, special diets, measuring the food, time feeders. That's a diabetic cat waiting to happen, or a cat that's going to end up with orthopedic disease, having trouble grooming, shortened life expectancy, all those things. We really need to be addressing this, and I'm glad that she's working with a veterinarian that's helping her do that. But just go about it very slowly. And anything you can do to increase exercise is going to help burn calories as well. So lots of toys on strings and wands and so on. That's going to be really helpful.
All right. And boy, here we are about out of time in the last 30 seconds or so, any advice during this holiday season and this winter season?
Well, I think number one is just being aware of doors being opened, who's in your house, what's in your house, and, you know, it, being extra, extra careful and watchful. And that caller that said, you know, about bringing pets into the house as new pets, really try to avoid that. No matter what your kids beg and plead, you know, try to make sure that you do it after the holidays. And I hope everybody has a wonderful December here. And I'm actually coming back a week early.
Yeah, you'll be back next month. January 7th?
January 7th, yes.
Thank you so much,
You're
Sandy.
Welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. Great to have her along. Thank you for listening. Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, joins us tomorrow here on the Ideas Network. Please stay with us. Lots more in store.